today at Reader's Corner, Don E. Carlton, author of Conversations with Cronkite.
Walter had a keen sense of the ephemeral nature of fame based on broadcasting. I'm not sure anyone had his credibility. So you have to ascribe a lot of this to Walter's personality, and that really was something that everybody could take to the bank. Walter really was dedicated to this whole idea of totally objective news. He wasn't naive. He understood that we're all products of our prejudices and so forth, but by God, he just really felt it was a standard he could at least work as hard as he could to get to.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In today's overheated and often caustic media environment, it's hard to imagine any journalist being so widely admired that viewers would consider him the most trusted man in America. Yet when Walter Cronkite retired from the anchor desk of the CBS Evening News 30 years ago, the nation's sense of loss left little doubt about why he had earned that moniker. In his book, Conversations with Cronkite, Don E. Carlton offers a first-person look at the legendary newsman whose career chronicled the great events of the late 20th century. Presented in a question-and-answer interview format, the book's material came from more than 60 hours of recordings done by Carlton and Cronkite in preparation for Cronkite's 1996 best-selling autobiography, A Reporter's Life. Walter Cronkite, who died in 2009, is posthumously listed as a co-author of this follow-up book. Today, we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Dr. Carlton. He is executive director of the Dolph Briscoe Center for American History at the University of Texas at Austin. His close relationship with Cronkite began in 1988 when Cronkite donated his personal and professional papers to the Briscoe Center's News Media History Archive, one of the country's most important archives on the history of television and newspaper journalism. Don Carlton joins us today by phone for this interview. Don Carlton, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's a delight to be with you.
So how did you get to the point of being Walter Cronkite's trusted researcher and historical advisor for his autobiography, first in A Reporter's Life, and then later this series of interviews? I know it says in that introduction there that he donated his papers. Is that when you first met him?
It is. Of course, you know, like so many baby boomers, I had known Walter for 34 years. I should say, put quotes around known. I felt like he was an old friend, even though we had never met. So it was a funny thing. Yeah, when I decided to create a news media history archive at the Briscoe Center, I thought, you know, what would be the best way to get this started? And Walter had just left the Evening News a few years before that. This is the late 80s. And I thought, gee, you know, I'm going to go talk to Walter Cronkite, and that would be a great way to launch this effort. He loved the idea. That's how we met, and we worked together. I worked very closely with him pulling his papers. His papers were scattered all over the place, and, of course, there were a lot of them actually at CBS. And there was a lot of negotiating to do with CBS as well, because a lot of his work at CBS, of course, was work for hire, so CBS was very much involved in that. But at any rate, about 2 years after we started working together, we got to be good friends during that period of time, and he called me out of the blue over a holiday period, literally, and said, talk to me about, you know, he needed to do his memoir. He had signed a contract with Random House several years before, actually. It was kind of funny. They were very patient with him, to say the least. But at any rate, he needed to get going on it, and he said that he just didn't even know where to start. And he knew that I had done a lot of oral history work as a historian, and that my specialty is 20th century media and political history. So he did me the great honor of asking to be his cohort in working on this project to produce a memoir. That's how we got started, and eventually got the book out in 96, and it's been in print ever since.
Apparently, he didn't really think it was going to be that big of a deal. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. You know, Walter had a keen sense of the ephemeral nature of fame, first of all, and second, the ephemeral nature of fame based on broadcasting. he could see in his life all of these well-known people who had become extremely, you know, very big celebrities in their day, who were radio broadcasters in particular. One of the reasons he wanted to get a book done, in fact, was the temporary nature of broadcasts. You know, he had been off the air by the time we started working for about 7 years, 8 years, something like that. And he had just persuaded himself that no one remembered him. And I never quite bought all of that. But there was some seriousness to that, actually. Because, like I said, he just the world he lived in, he could see that a lot of people just disappear who were quite celebrated at one point.
What were the circumstances of his leaving? Did he just decide one day he didn't want to be an anchorman anymore, or was CBS News also interested in a new breed?
Well, he actually, and his belief is, and I think all the evidence supports him, is that he just had gotten tired of the daily grind of doing that evening news program. And there was a tradition at CBS to retire at 65. Of course, Bill Paley and Frank Stanton both broke that tradition. But nonetheless, there was a pretty good tradition there to do that. And I really believe he just was really getting antsy. I think he wanted to do special projects and so forth and at CBS. He wasn't in any way retiring. He never intended to retire from CBS and get off the air. He was simply leaving the CBS Evening News. And I think, you know, at that time of his life, he was so into sailing and doing a lot of different kinds of things. And I think he just felt tied down as he got older.
But he was a little disappointed in the way that worked out. As I remember one of your interviews, he talked about how he had thought there was going to be more of an opportunity for him to do specials and various reports and analyses. And I don't remember who it was, but somebody pretty much stood in the way of that. And maybe it was Rather who just said, I need more space. Is that correct?
Well, Walter admitted to me, well, first of all, he strongly believed, yeah, absolutely, that someone kept him, that he was kept off of the air at CBS. And to go back to your original question, yes, he did not intend to retire from the air. And technically, he didn't retire from CBS. He maintained a contract, an annual contract with them till the day he died, actually. But he thought that he was going to be given a lot more airtime than he really did. Especially he, for the first couple of years after he left CBS Evening News, he did a program called Walter Cronkite's Universe, and he had his own unit, and he was able to do some interesting things and really enjoyed it. But they canceled that, and from then on, he was pretty much left off the air. His greatest disappointment, he really believed that he was going to be able to continue. And maybe he was naive in this respect, but he thought he could continue anchoring political conventions and national elections, which he loved to do and which were his forte. And that didn't happen. So he was very disappointed and somewhat bitter about it, frankly.
Well, wasn't that where he really was discovered as this warm and intimate guy that you could actually sit down before your TV and watch? Didn't he do one of the very early political conventions?
Yes, he did. His breakthrough was in 1952, the two political conventions in 1952, the national political conventions. And we've got to remember that in 52 and even as late as 56 and maybe even 60, but really 52, was one of the last of the real brokered kind of conventions both conventions that really mattered in the sense of they were doing deals, and it was a real old traditional convention. And, you know, it was kind of a lot of action, and a lot of people, you weren't quite sure where things were going to go, and was Taft going to unseat Eisenhower, and was Stevenson going to be stopped, and so forth. And so there was a lot of drama to those conventions, and things actually got done there. And his coverage and the way he handled those two conventions really made him a national figure. That's where he really, really started.
You're listening to Professor Don Carlton of the University of Texas. He's the author of Conversations with Cronkite by Walter Cronkite and Don Carlton. Now, when I look back on that era, I think of people like Huntley and Brinkley, and even after Huntley died, Brinkley continued on and did a great job for NBC, then John Chancellor, Howard K. Smith over at ABC. I don't know the exact time frames here, but it strikes me as that, roughly speaking, those folks were his contemporaries, and yet Cronkite's the guy that emerges as the most trusted man in America. What is it about Cronkite that sets him apart from these other guys who were really outstanding journalists and TV anchor men in their own right, and yet he seems to get a cut above it? Is it just the Cronkite personality? How do you attribute the fact that Cronkite's the guy that comes out on top among this incredible group of journalists and newsmen?
Well, Bob, I think it is a combination of that. Bill Paley poured an awful lot of money into the CBS News. They had a strong historical tradition, really going back, of course, with Edward R. Murrow. And a name that's often kind of forgotten today is Bob Trout, who was yes. also a pioneer. And they had this tradition, historical tradition. They had the resources. Bill Paley believed that the news was important. Bill Paley being, of course, the owner of CBS. So I think that Walter had an incredible team, no question about that. But I think that, you know, so did Douglas Edwards. And Douglas Edwards was
That's
Walter's
right.
predecessor. Mm-hmm. And so you have to ascribe this, a lot of this, to Walter's personality and his ability to create trust on the part of the viewer, his credibility. I'm not sure anyone had his credibility, or certainly no one has his credibility today. And that really was something that everybody could take to the bank. He was dependable. That's why he was called Uncle Walter. People felt like their uncle, their beloved uncle, was coming into their living room or whatever and telling them what happened and exactly what the news was. And you know, Walter really was dedicated to this whole idea that may be a standard impossible to reach of totally objective news. We often talked about that. He understood. He wasn't naive. He understood that we're all products of our prejudices and so forth. But by God, he just really felt it was a standard he could at least work as hard as he could to get to. And I think people got that from him. They knew that he wasn't editorializing, he wasn't politicizing the news. So I think it's a combination of both CBS's reputation and the way Walter really did this. You know, Walter was really a newspaper man, and that governed so much of the way he handled the news. He really always saw himself as a reporter, not a newsreader, and that was one of the things that helped him a lot.
Speaking of that reporter's background and the analytical ability that it brings to the job, do any of the newsreaders today, the anchor men and women that we watch at evening news, do any of them have reporting backgrounds? I don't know of any, but maybe there's somebody out there.
Gosh, that's a good question. You know, that we have so many anchors now.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, I was thinking mainly of the, in this case, I was thinking of network news.
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't know all about Brian Williams' background. I think they're basically newsreaders, personalities.
Well, speaking of Brian Williams, one of the things I've noticed in recent years is that people like Brian Williams and Brokaw before him and Katie Couric, they all wind up on these evening, the late shows. Letterman is always talking to Brian Williams and Brokaw. Did Cronkite do that? And the reason I bring it up is that it seems that, for me anyway, it removes the objectivity that you expect from these folks at the news desk at 6 o'clock when they're opining at 11 o'clock about the Iraqi war or about some health issue or domestic issue. And I look back and think back, and I don't ever remember seeing Walter anywhere but at his desk reporting the news.
Well, that's because CBS had a very strict policy. They really had a wall between entertainment and the news that they insisted on. And it was a very strict wall. And, in fact, interestingly enough, even Walter, as well as some of the people on the news side, sometimes chafed a little bit about not being able to do some of that. And that is, I mean, appear on the entertainment side. There was a constant war within CBS about that. But that's why you didn't see the CBS News personalities and reporters doing that much on the entertainment side at all, because CBS didn't want them to. For the very reason that you just mentioned about the concern about their not being objective or becoming too much of a celebrity as opposed to a serious news person, you know, that sort of thing.
In those days, there really was an oligopoly of news reporting in the sense that you went to one of the three channels or you didn't go anywhere at all. And today, obviously, I think you mentioned a little, there's so many more outlets. Could Cronkite pull it off today in this cable?
Yeah, Walter told me many times, I spent a lot of time with him after we did our book and we'd watch, I'd be with him on the Vineyard. He had a place on Martha's Vineyard, he and his wife, Betsy, and we'd have a drink at a certain time, and then we'd watch the news. And we used to talk about this. No, there's the news outlets, it was just too diffuse. He told me several times that there was no way his career would have been the same if he had been born several years later and was working today. It'd be totally different. I don't know that we can ever have another Walter Cronkite. I just don't think that it's not that there aren't people out there who maybe could fill the bill. It's just that structurally the media is so diffuse now that it's just not possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, whether you're talking about the 24-hour news cycle, that in itself, I would think, is something that was very different from the time Walter, basically Walter reported for a half an hour, and that was it until 24 hours later.
Well, it's ironic. Walter really envied the fact that there were 24/7 news outlets. And the reason that's ironic is because he always fought a losing battle with CBS to have an hour news broadcast instead of the 30-minute one. If you recall, when he started out, they had a 15-minute broadcast, and they just kept pushing and pushing and pushing and finally won a war, broadcast war, to go ahead and go to half an hour. And he still was unsatisfied with a half an hour. He just thought that was hopelessly inadequate and really wanted an hour. Well, after the 24/7 cables came through and everything, he used to laugh. We'd sit there and he'd go, gosh, it just would have been great. We could have done so many things, you know. He was a news junkie, and he enjoyed the idea of 24/7. He didn't like the way it had developed and some of the negative aspects of it, but he did envy that.
Well, with MSNBC on one side of the ledger and Fox News on the other, I guess I have to ask you, did he – I don't remember again exactly whether he was around to see the way it is today, but what did he think of the fact that some of these cable channels have really chosen up sides?
Drove him crazy.
Yeah.
When we first started working, Fox wasn't on the, back in the 90s, Fox wasn't even in existence. There was no Fox News channel. CNN had started and was on the air and so forth, but still hadn't dominated in any way the three network news outlets. But as I said, I stayed close to him over the years, and the MSNBC and Fox thing just drove him crazy. I mean, he just, to despair, frankly. They were, as far as he was concerned, they were not news outlets. They were political outlets, and Fox in particular drove him crazy. He felt very strongly that Fox News was an arm of the Republican Party, and he thought that was extremely dangerous. Dangerous to democracy, I should add.
Right. Cronkite is the only journalist to ever be voted among the top 10 most influential decision makers in America. I think that was a survey conducted by U.S. News & World Report. Did he ever comment to you on that and how he felt as a journalist being identified as an influential decision maker, period, like alongside LBJ or whoever it might be?
Well, it was a great... He was honored. He made it clear to me that he accepted the honor and felt greatly honored by that. But he also, it was a burden in that he felt that he really just had to behave and conduct himself in a way that he was constantly having that hovering over him a bit. It was a bit of a burden. He wasn't in any way going to reject it. I mean, don't get me wrong, but still,
okay.
It still was a bit of a burden, you know, and it kept him from speaking out on some matters that were very important to him, I think. But now later in life, he opened up somewhat more. But I think as long as he was the anchor, he just would not. He was very hesitant to make any kind of statements that could be judged as editorializing. You know, the irony, the funny thing about it, though, is he actually did a lot of editorializing on his radio program on CBS, and he kept waiting for the other shoe to fall because of that, that somehow that would actually tear down this reputation. But then he said, but no one ever listened, so it didn't matter.
You're listening to Professor Don Carlton of the University of Texas. He's the author of Conversations with Cronkite, by Walter Cronkite and Don Carlton. Don, let's pick up on this decision-making aspect of Walter Cronkite's career and the impact he had. He became, without a doubt, the greatest advocate of NASA and everything it was doing in space. I mean, I remember all those years when he reported, and he might as well have been getting his paycheck from NASA, not CBS News. And I do wonder in that case if, in fact, he became the story. He jumped right in. And, of course, in those days, I guess it's not like anybody was against NASA, but certainly Walter was an advocate, wouldn't you say?
Well, NASA, I mean, you know, Bob, NASA had its critics even then. And, you know, don't forget, this was the tumultuous 1960s. And a lot of people, even in the 60s, at the height of the space program, were criticizing the resources that were going to the space program. So the space program even then had its critics, and Walter was very defensive about that, quite frankly. And he wasn't just defensive of NASA, he was defensive of his own advocation, of his advocacy of the space program. And he remained defensive, really, until he died about it. He was very proud of the space program. He's very proud of his involvement of it, in it. But he was also aware that he had his critics, basically stating what you just said, that he was really more, he had become part of the story. And I think that he was conflicted about that, frankly.
He also was known for LBJ's comment during the Vietnam War, and I guess this is one of those moments when Walter to some extent crosses the line, and he comes back from Vietnam and calls the war futile in a news special that he put together from his reporting. And LBJ says, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost the country. I guess there's always going to be a great debate whether that caused everything to fall apart as far as LBJ is concerned. But your thoughts on how Walter looked at this period and especially his relationship with LBJ?
First of all, we have to remember that Walter did not make that statement on the evening news. This is very important. Walter insisted that his report from Vietnam, after he came back from being in Vietnam and after the Tet Offensive in 68, it was a special broadcast. It was not a news program. It was a CBS, I don't know if technically it was a CBS reports program, but it was something like the old CBS reports. And he wanted to make certain that there was a wall there between his news report, his evening news report, and his statements on the special program, which he made clear was commentary. So I think that's important. He still maintained that wall between reporting the news and editorializing. Now, having said that, going back, with Vietnam, you have to understand that Walter was covered World War II. He was in the North African landings. He covered the 8th Air Force bombing of Germany. He was in Holland during the liberation of Holland. He was shot at. He was in firefights. He was a product of the World War II generation who had won the war. And our military leadership had won that war, as far as he was concerned. And he was really kind of a cheerleader for the military going into Vietnam. He was very supportive of the Vietnam War. Tet and what he learned when he went to Vietnam, that he had been lied to, as far as he was concerned, was a great, great moment of disillusionment to him. He came back from Vietnam a changed man, frankly. It comes out in that report. And he felt that this was significant enough. This wasn't just some minor thing that you could editorialize about. This was about the life and death of the country. And he felt that he needed to speak out on that.
What did Cronkite think of Eisenhower, given the fact that you know, he thought military leadership was so much responsible for our victories in World War II? Ike comes back to run for president.
Huge fan of Dwight Eisenhower's, and got to be a friend of Eisenhower's later in life, and later in Eisenhower's life, and did a presidential broadcast memoir with Eisenhower that was several broadcasts, the only one that Eisenhower did, actually. And they did a memorable program on D-Day. It was called D-Day Plus 20, 20 years after the D-Day invasion, and did an incredible special program where he went with Eisenhower and literally on the beaches of Normandy and had Eisenhower explain and point out various things. It's a great, if you've never seen the documentary, it's a great program.
What's the name of the documentary?
D-Day Plus 20.
D-Day Plus 20, okay. Well, he didn't exactly have the same impression of Nixon.
No, he did not, but it's complicated. But he thought Nixon was crazy, basically, literally, clinically, maybe mentally ill. But that he had strong talent and intelligence and felt that he was, interestingly enough, in the 1960 election campaign, was actually more straightforward and truthful and dealt with the press better than Kennedy did. He felt dodged questions, and I don't know, he had a problem with Kennedy in that 60 election, Walter did. But the famous broadcast where he announces Kennedy's assassination, Walter broke up because he respected the presidency, and he didn't dislike John Kennedy. I mean, he knew it was a horrible tragedy. But it's a little more complex than what you might think. I'm talking about his view of Nixon and Kennedy.
Well, especially since at the end of his career, he did admit the fact that he was basically a liberal or a progressive. I forget what words he used in your interviews with him. And
He used the word liberal. Yeah.
Liberal, yeah.
Yeah, he never ran from the word liberal and never understood why anyone did.
The Watergate affair and his views of that episode.
Oh, well, one of the great political tragedies, constitutional crises in the history of the United States. And we have the Watergate archive here at the university, and I was talking to Bob Woodward recently about it, and he was telling me, he said, you know, if it hadn't have been Walter Cronkite, that this story would have never gotten legs. The story that was being published in the Washington Post, Woodward told me, was basically not being read. And it was Walter's special program where he spent time explaining what happened in Watergate using Woodward and Bernstein's material and giving them full credit is what gave their story legs, according to Woodward and Bernstein, actually. And they both feel that Walter should have gotten a lot more credit for bringing that story into the national limelight. And I think they're absolutely true. I think it's exactly the case. But he thought it was a terrible, you know, abuse of power in a democracy by the president.
Well, with that, Don, we're going to have to close off here. We've run out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Don Carlton. Next week, Ron Powers, author of the biography Mark Twain, A Life. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.